Mr. Levy. Yeah, Mr. Lovey.
Morning, Your Honors. I am John Lovey. I'm here. I represent Chris Parrish. And I think that everybody can agree that this was, in fact, an anomalous verdict, whether you measure it on the extent to which it deviates from the comparables that either side was able to locate, less than 1% of the average that all clustered very neatly along a distribution, together with the evidence in the record.
Could I just stop you? Because
sure.
There's something that I really would like to get to, and it's this. Did you, in fact, try to introduce at trial testimony from the victims that they now believed Michael Irvin was the shorter intruder, or at least testimony that they no longer believe that Mr. Parrish was the perpetrator? And if so, what I would like to know is where in the record will we find that?
We absolutely did proffer that repeatedly, maybe a half dozen times, three times in writing, and at least once a day as the trial proceeded. The judge ruled within 2 minutes of considering the issue on the first day of trial at the motion in limine hearings, anything that requires any mention of the co-defendant is out at this trial. And he never, as you know, I plan to argue this morning, he never explained why that was going to be. But we then made a written proffer of the types of evidence we wanted to introduce, and one of them was exactly what Your Honor described. And we refer you to our brief on pages 39 and 40, where we lay out all of the different proffers. And included within that was the evidence that the victims at the deposition, the part that was read to the jury, said, yeah, we think it was Chris Parrish, we saw his picture, or we dropped the book. But then Judge Lozano's order required us to redact out the part where they say, you know what, we're no longer sure it was Parrish. Because now that we understand that there was this guy with the DNA, and he had the brother, and we've seen the brother's picture, we don't stand by the identification anymore. So,
in other words, it's not just that you weren't permitted, you were forced to also redact.
Absolutely.
And that's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line. The same deposition. The witnesses would have, you know, they said that they thought Parrish was guilty, and then they started crying and say, we no longer think that, and that's the part Judge Lozano excluded. So when we get to the extent to which this verdict was a great deviation and really was divorced from the evidence in the record, Judge Lozano said, I'll give you that. He said, I agree that this verdict, you know, that there's usually much higher, but here you couldn't prove your guy was innocent. The jury undoubtedly harbored doubts about his guilt. And if the jury harbored doubts about his guilt, then it was perfectly reasonable for them to give a small award. And we don't, frankly, take issue with that. But the reason we're in this room is because we had extremely probative evidence that would have shown his innocence. And it really was, therefore, a perfect storm of error. We had great evidence on innocence. There was never an explanation for why we weren't allowed to put it in. And everybody, including the defendants, agrees that it would have changed the outcome. Because they say the reason you got the low award is because you couldn't prove you were innocent. So I'd like to start with the probative value.
Well, let me go back, sure, though, to the alibi witnesses, because they were called at the criminal trial. They were not called at the civil trial.
Well, actually, they were. Their testimony was introduced at the civil trial, and that is in our reply brief. In a footnote, we cite the Exhibit 100. In other words, the criminal trial transcript was introduced as evidence. So all,
but none of them appeared before the jury.
Well,
other than
family,
through the,
right,
deposition.
Well, the family
members. I mean, through the prior testimony.
Correct, Your Honor, although you're talking about a party 15 years ago, and, you know, the people that knew him were in court, but the people who didn't know him, you know, that's like asking you to be an alibi witness for somebody who was in a party 15 years ago. Frankly, the alibi witness was some evidence of innocence, but it wasn't persuasive. It wasn't enough. He got convicted beyond a reasonable doubt despite having presented the alibi witness. What he needed was the new evidence, this DNA hit, which I'd like to talk about. And Judge Lozano ruled that this is not probative, and that is just simply an indefensible conclusion. Let's talk about the first piece. The person who stands convicted today of the crime says, I've never met Chris Parrish, I've never been in a room with him, and I certainly never committed a crime with him. That is some evidence that Chris Parrish is innocent. And you know what might not have been clear from our brief? But I want to make two observations. First of all, the case against Parrish was relatively weak. It was all eyewitness identifications, cross-racial identifications made in a very blurry situation. There was never any motive, never any physical evidence, never any reason to believe Chris Parrish had ever met these people. So if the whole case was based on eyewitness identifications, then it wouldn't have taken much to tip it over. And the second point I want to make is that how do you prove your innocence? You know, if you're accused of being in an apartment in a home invasion, and there's no videotape or DNA, how do you prove your innocence? And I would submit that the evidence we have here is evidence of the most persuasive character that's going to be available. We couldn't do better than what we have here. The DNA from the tall intruder's hat hit a match to a man named Jolanus Irvin. You know, the hat had a big J on it, and Jolanus happens to be 6'3", African-American, and the victims now happen to believe he is, in fact, the shooter. He says, I have never met Chris Parrish, never been in a room with him, never met, committed a crime with him. So we can prove who the shooter was, and him and Parrish can prove different towns, different peer groups. They have no relationship to each other. That is some evidence that Parrish had nothing to do with the crime. But of course,
being prosecuted, or is the statute of limitations run, or what?
No, it hasn't, and it's a shame that he's not being prosecuted. That would require the system to admit it made a mistake. They got Cooper to dismiss his post-conviction petition in exchange for accepting responsibility for it. So he said, fine, time served. I'm done with the justice system. I don't trust this. So the system is not prosecuting Jolanus, nor are they prosecuting Jolanus' brother. Jolanus has a partner in crime who's sitting in jail with him in Michigan because they go around robbing people, and they're in for murder right now with guns. And Jolanus' brother, Michael Irvin, has a big round face, and the victims at their deposition say, we're looking at that guy's picture. He could be Parrish's twin. We have real doubts. Under Judge Lozano's order, we couldn't present that testimony. All we had was the victim saying, when we saw Parrish's picture, we dropped the book. And then when you get to the part of the deposition, say, you know what, this guy Michael Irvin looks an awful lot like, and it gives us doubts, that we weren't allowed to present. And the real travesty of it is, why? Judge Lozano never offered any coherent explanation for why this evidence was going to be excluded. We challenged them. Over and over, I stood next to my opponents and said, somebody tell me why this is not being in. It's clearly probative. Where's the prejudice? Can anybody make a nonsensical argument why there's unfair prejudice here? And I respect my opponents, and they don't like to make bad arguments. And they didn't. They did not posit any prejudice because there is none. This evidence would have been relevant on liability anyways. In fact, if we had lost the trial, that would have been our appeal. We would have said we should have been able to prove that the eyewitnesses, you know, were suggested, et cetera, based on this evidence. So there was no unfair prejudice. All Judge Lozano did was he kept incanting the phrase danger of unfair prejudice. And at one point he said confusion. But I'll tell you what, Your Honors, the only thing confusing about this trial was when we had to tell the story without mentioning anything about the identity of the co-defendant. We had to excise the police reports. There's big swaths of whiteout that the jury would see. So that was what was confusing. All the witnesses, Rizzutko, they had to sort of tell their story while trying not to mention that there was a co-defendant. So how did this happen? How did this go so badly awry? And that's where really justice is on our side. We showed up for the first day of trial, as we laid out in our brief, and Judge Lozano, we started arguing the motions, and he says, I've been on trial. I've had 3 or 4 trials in the last 3 weeks. You guys given me 3 inches of motions in limine. You're throwing names at me. Is this even my case? I'm not sure what I should do with this motion to eliminate. And he said, how about we take some time so we can not make a mistake? And we said, great idea, Judge. You know, the trial's tomorrow. Judge says, I got to leave at 3. The jury's going to be here in the morning. And the defendant said, no. And then Judge Lozano said, and then we formally moved for a continuance, and then we formally moved for a mistrial.
What do you mean the defendant said no?
What happened was Judge Lozano said to the defendants, listen, this is a big issue, and I've been known to make some screwball rulings. And you want to be back here in the Seventh Circuit if we get reversed? He even used the word reversed. And they powwowed, and they came back and they said, Judge, we'll take our chances. Thank you very much for the advice, but we'll do it. Let's pick a jury.
And here we are today.
And here we are today, and hopefully it's Judgment Day. So unless there are further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Lovey. Mr. Weir? I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong...
May it please the court, counsel for the plaintiff. Yes, Your Honor. Martin Kuss for the city of Elkhart, and I will speak for 10 minutes unless asked to do more. and reserve the rest of my the defendant's time to Mr. Williams. The jury in this case listened to 6 days of evidence, arguments. Seventh day, it deliberated for 9 hours. There were no interruptions, no questions, and came out with a verdict in favor of Mr. Parrish.
Well, hardly.
Hardly in favor. It was six days, but it didn't have critical evidence from the from Mr. Parrish.
Well, there's no critical evidence missing from Mr. Parrish with regard to his claim against the city of Elkhart or Rizzutko. I would remind the court that this case has been, as you know, was up on appeal.
Now, look, if the jury believes that he was guilty, then they're not going to give him much because one way to think of how a jury should think about this, I think, is that if he's guilty, then he's certainly responsible in significant part for having been imprisoned, right? And so that would be a reason for the jury to give such a small award. But once it looks as if he's actually was innocent, then we know from the other cases that he would get a much larger judgment. I don't see any basis for the judge having excluded the evidence that suggested he was innocent.
Well, maybe you could answer this very definitive question, because given that their earlier identification of Parrish as the intruder was entered, on what basis could the court exclude that evidence? What basis? I mean, even if he didn't want to get into a mini trial as to the Irvin brothers or Cooper, shouldn't the court have at least allowed testimony that the victims no longer believed that Parrish was the perpetrator?
Well, Your Honor, you're talking about evidence of Cooper being in the apartment?
I'm talking about the whole shebang. Why none of this was allowed in.
Mm-hmm. Because for the very reasons he stated, we would have had two and maybe three mm-hmm. trials within our trial.
Mm-hmm. So what? You would have had justice,
look,
perhaps.
This is material evidence. The fact that it'll extend the trial is completely irrelevant.
No, it's the balancing that this experienced jurist did at the time.
No, he wasn't. I mean, look what Mr. Lovey read from his business about his screwball rulings, and he doesn't know if this is his case and so on.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, but
anyway,
you agree, no matter
what he said, he didn't give any justification for excluding the evidence of Parrish's innocence.
I respectfully disagree with that. The next day, the judge, he took it under advisement, and he did, in fact, and it's in the record, he said, I have reviewed this again. He didn't just make this...
What does it mean he reviewed? What is the basis for excluding evidence of innocence? Tell me what the basis is. Tell me what the basis in law is. Don't interrupt me.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I apologize.
What is the basis in law for excluding evidence of innocence when you're trying to calculate damages for illegal imprisonment?
That it is this particular evidence, when balanced with the confusion it might cause,
would it cause? The jury would decide either he was innocent or he might be innocent, or no, we think he was guilty, right? What's the confusion?
Well, because we're introducing the three letters DNA 8 years after the event.
So like what? Every other case today.
What difference does that make? Eight years after the event.
I'm sorry.
Tell me what difference it makes that the DNA was 8 years old.
Because it is not, there was nothing that was probative to Mr. Parrish.
Of course there was. And Mr. Lovey explained that. Of course it was material. The eyewitnesses changing their mind and so on, of course it's material. Suggestive eyewitness identification by Rizzuco, whatever his name is.
Yes, it's Detective Rizzuco.
A leg to stand on.
Well, let me at least hobble through the rest of this particular argument.
It'll definitely be hobbling because you have such
a long road.
You have such a long road to hold. Because Cooper says he had no idea who Parrish was. These depositions, given the jury's given depositions with the blackouts, where the part of the witnesses say they believe now that their identifications are bad. I mean, whether you're hobbling or not, I don't see how you get up the hill.
Well, Your Honor, and I see my lights on, but I'm going to interfere with Mr. Williams at the risk of not letting him have the pleasure of standing before you under these circumstances.
What a kind man you are.
Yes, ma'am. Here's what the perspective was at the trial. Mr. Parrish presented to the jury a number of facts that were his allegation of damages. And bear with me just a moment.
Well, no, we understand that. We understand he was cross-examined. He was caught in some things that he had to admit were wrong, or you were able to show he was wrong. And the jury certainly could weigh that, too, when they were dealing with damages. But he didn't have anything to help support his claim that he was innocent because all that evidence had been excluded. So that would be part of the whole mix.
Well,
so that all came before the jury, how he tried to impeach him, and certainly he was not the most credible guy. Everybody understands that. But he didn't have the rest of his case was not there for the jury to evaluate.
Well, that's fair comment to a point. He had the Irvins who could have said, no, hard to believe the Irvins would take the stand and say, I did it, I was there. They were listed as witnesses. That's one. He had the alibi witnesses, which you've suggested. That's two. He had...
But the eyewitnesses, Kirshner and Cannell, who were the ones who made the ID, they were the ones who the part of their deposition wasn't included.
But they identified Parrish. And I understand. They had Love. Mr. Love was present...
I think the jury only gave him, what, $9,000 a year?
Thank you. This is what I think, since you've asked me, the one who was in the trenches. I think Mr. Parrish was an exceedingly poor job as a witness for himself. That happens. I think not only was he impeached, I think the jury, he was impeached, and then he would do things to rehabilitate himself that the jury did not believe the damages allegations. And I'm going to, you've seen it in the briefs, but it bears this point. He came before that jury, said he was fully employed and he wasn't. But he didn't admit that. He had to be caught. He had to be told. He gave.
What does that have to do with the damage, with the 9,000?
Well, the jury could have believed he was either less than fully employed.
What difference does it make? How do you justify the $9,000 per year for being imprisoned?
Well, Your Honor, we haven't even touched on it, but there's throughout the entire trial, the allegation is it was a reversal, not on an exoneration. It's a reversal based upon inadequacy of his criminal defense trial counsel.
You're not listening to me.
I'm sorry.
What is the theory on which his only damages were $9,000 a year?
That, number one, he didn't suffer economic damages. Number two, his separation from his family, as he said, was not as significant.
So prison is fine. It's the equivalent of being on the outside.
Sorry. I knew I was going to fall into that. No, I'm not. Now, I understand that was argued.
It's a ridiculous figure, the 9,000, except if the jury thought he was guilty. That's your problem.
Well, Your Honor.
You've made a big mistake. You should not have defended this. That's a big mistake. Your position is frivolous.
Well, Your Honor, is there anything else that you would like to talk with me about or ask me any questions based on that pointed remark?
Now, we thank you for your efforts, and we'll give Mr. Williams a minute or so if you'd like. What, do you represent one of the individuals or what?
May it please the court. There was more than just the fact that the jury may have, or the possibility that the jury may have believed that Mr. Parrish was actually guilty of the crime. There was the ineffective assistance of counsel, and I know that it's been discounted here somewhat, but it's very important. It's important to recognize the fact that that is the reason why his conviction was reversed. The jury heard that. The jury heard that his conviction was reversed because his counsel was ineffective. The jury heard him say that he had claims against his counsel. The jury heard him say that he blamed his counsel along with everybody else, that there was plenty of blame to go around.
What does this have to do with anything?
Well, Your Honor, it's another explanation for why the jury reached the verdict that it did.
Well, why? If an innocent person goes to prison because of ineffective assistance of counsel, why would that make the jury cut down his damages? I don't get that.
Because, Your Honor, the constitutional violation that the jury found...
I know, but if the jury thought that because of the... I mean, we have ineffective assistance concept because we think effective assistance might actually be important to someone getting to an innocent person, right? So why would a jury think that if the basis of your being released was that you had ineffective assistance, it must mean you were guilty.
It wasn't that they would think that he was guilty, Your Honor. It's that there was no causation.
No causation?
Yeah, that the constitutional violation wasn't the cause of the imprisonment. It was the ineffective assistance of counsel that caused the imprisonment.
What was the cause of the imprisonment, then?
The ineffective assistance of counsel, because his attorney did not do his criminal... defense attorney did not.
This is the whole point of why he wants to present evidence of innocence, so that the jury won't draw the inference you suggest, which is he got off on a technicality.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, if I could speak briefly to the evidence issue.
Because basically what you want us to hold is when it's you get off on an ineffective assistance claim, then in the damages trial, you are not allowed to prove that you were innocent. I mean, and that doesn't make any sense, because doesn't that aggravate to a huge extent the ineffective assistance of counsel if you're innocent?
Your Honor, I don't disagree with that. What I would say, though, in response to that is they weren't prevented from introducing evidence of his innocence. There were plenty of things that they could have done that they chose not to do.
And I have no reason to exclude any of this evidence that he excluded, and you should have told Judge Lozano that you didn't object to that evidence, because you and your co-counsel, you've taken a completely indefensible position. It's a frivolous defense. It's frivolous. If you don't understand that, I mean, you did a very good job in the last argument. I don't understand you and Mr. Coos. I don't know where you get what you're thinking about.
Your Honor,
it's not arguable. It's a ridiculous position you're taking. If you thought about it for 5 minutes, thinking of it as a person not representing someone, you'd realize you have a frivolous defense. That $9,000 damages figure is preposterous unless they thought he was guilty. Mm-hmm. You understand that much, don't you? That they would not have awarded just $9,000 if they had thought he was innocent, right? Will you go that far? You won't even concede that.
Your Honor, I believe there were other explanations for why. Thank you.
We'll go on to the next case.